Welcome to Disciple Dojo. We're continuing our walk through the Psalms. If you've missed the previous entry in this series, check out the playlist here on the channel where you can find all of the Psalms that we go through. Our goal is to not necessarily do in-depth exegesis of every line of every Psalm, but rather to read through the Psalms together, to walk through, maybe point out some things you might have missed, some interesting things about the language, compare different translations, just to give you and me familiarity with the Psalms that we may not have. You know, they all kind of run together when you just number them. Psalm 8, Psalm 2, Psalm 27, Psalm 45. We don't really know off the top of our head what they're about. So hopefully this series will help kind of ground the idea of each of the Psalms into our minds a little bit better. And then we'll have kind of a lay of the land when we want to study them a little more in depth on our own. Our Bible teaching videos don't get as many clicks as like study Bible reviews or more hot button topics. But really, I look at them as the foundation of what Disciple Dojo is. So if you appreciate this kind of thing, we would appreciate you subscribing and helping us continue to grow this channel. All right, so let's jump in and look at Psalm 9. Now, the first thing to mention is Psalm 9 and Psalm 10 are considered by many people to originally have been one psalm. In fact, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, which is older than the Masoretic text that our Bibles translate from, this is one psalm. Psalm 9 and 10 in Greek Bibles are just Psalm 9. And then Psalm 11, 12, and 13 and on in Greek Bibles are Psalm 10, 11, and 12. So that's why between the Septuagint and the English and Hebrew Bibles, you get different numbering systems in the Psalms. They kind of get off track for the bulk of the book. And it's because Psalm 9 and 10 are one psalm in the Septuagint. And so we're going to kind of look at them together. We're going to treat them in two separate videos. So we're going to just look at Psalm 9 in this video, but with the understanding that Psalm 10 is the sequel or the second half of a diptych. Psalm 10 does not have a title line. It just starts right off. That's why Psalm 10, the numbers in English Bibles are not different than the number in Hebrew Bibles, because there's no superscription for Psalm 10. Now, besides not having its own title superscription, Psalm 9 and 10 are also considered to have been an original psalm because some people think that they form an acrostic. Acrostic is when like the first line begins with A, the second line begins with B, the third line begins with C, the fourth line begins with D, and so on, only obviously in Hebrew. So it'd be Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, all the way through the Hebrew alphabet. Now, there are a number of Psalms that do that. And in fact, the Book of Lamentations, for the most part, does that as well. So acrostic is a known feature of Hebrew poetry. But what makes it a little tricky is that Psalm 9 and 10 don't exactly form a perfect Hebrew acrostic. There are a few letters missing. There are a few letters that may have been transposed. It's not an airtight case that this is intended to be one acrostic. But you could make a good case for it, and some have said it initially or originally was, but that over time, before it got incorporated into scripture, that somehow parts of the acrostic got mixed up or some lines got dropped. But regardless, I'll show you what I mean. So here is my translation of Psalm 9 and 10. I translated them together, and I went and put the letters that are considered to form the acrostic in red. So you can see verse 2 is Aleph. Verse 4 is Beit. Verse 6, Gimel. There's no Dalet. Dalet is missing. Verse 7 is Hey. Verse 8 is Vav. Then you don't really get the Zion until down in verse 12. Chet, verse 14. Tet, verse 16. Yod, verse 18, Kaf, verse 19, and then Psalm 10, verse 1 starts with Lamed, but then there's no Mem, Nun, or Samek. The next letter in the acrostic is all the way down in the end of verse 8. There's the Ayin, and then there's not really a Pei that starts any of the verses. Some have said the Pei is actually up here in verse 7, this Pihu, that this was originally the Pei, and so they've gotten a little mixed up. I don't know, that seems a little forced. There's no Tzade. Then you do pick up with Kof in verse 12, Oresh verse 14. Then Shin is down in 15, and then Tau in verse 17, which is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So I don't know. I'm not convinced of the acrostic. I think it's possible, but it's by no means a given that this was originally an acrostic. Another argument that Psalm 9 and 10 should be read together, though, and I think this one is a little bit stronger, is the end of Psalm 9, the last word is Selah. And I don't know of very many, maybe there might not even be any places where Selah ends a psalm, where it's the conclusion of a psalm. Selah is usually, again, we don't know what the term Selah means. Scholars guess at it. There's no consensus on it. It's some type of notation, either poetic or musical, but it's usually kind of stuck in between verses where there's some sort of pause or emphasis or something like that. I'm not aware of any places except for this psalm, and I could be wrong because I haven't done a deep dive on every psalm. So if I'm wrong, I'm happy to be corrected on this, but I'm not aware of where Selah ends a psalm anywhere else. So if that's true, and Selah is right here in verse 20 in the Hebrew text, 21 in the English text, then that is a pretty good indicator that this is a pause, and Psalm 10:1 should pick right up where Psalm 9:20 left off. So regardless, you can read Psalm 9 and 10 separately, which is what the Hebrew Masoretic tradition does, or you can read them together, which is what the Septuagint, which is also an early Jewish tradition, does. I think we can do well just reading them and treating them as like two parts of a diptych, like panel one and panel two, because there are common vocabulary words that are found in both. And there are common themes that are found in both, and they do fit together nicely. So that's how we're going to treat them, kind of like the book of Psalms begins with Psalm 1 and Psalm 2, how they form sort of a single introduction into the entire book. We talked about that in our videos here on Psalm 1 and Psalm 2. I think that very well may could be the case with Psalm 9 and Psalm 10. But anyway, let's dive in. We're going to read Psalm 9. I'm going to read it in my old NIV, and then we're going to walk through it and look at some stuff in the Hebrew text. So Psalm 9 begins, "For the director of music, to the tune of The Death of the Son, a psalm of David. I will praise you, O Lord, with all my heart. I will tell of all your wonders. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. My enemies turn back. They stumble and perish before you, for you have upheld my right and my cause. You have sat on your throne judging righteously. You've rebuked the nations and destroyed the wicked. You've blotted out their name forever and ever. Endless ruin has overtaken the enemy. You have uprooted their cities. Even the memory of them has perished. The Lord reigns forever. He has established his throne for judgment. He will judge the world in righteousness. He will govern the peoples with justice. The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Those who know your name will trust in you, for you, Lord, have never forsaken those who seek you. Sing praises to the Lord enthroned in Zion. Proclaim among the nations what he has done. For he who avenges blood remembers. He does not ignore the cry of the afflicted. O Lord, see how my enemies persecute me. Have mercy and lift me up from the gates of death, that I may declare your praises in the gates of the daughter of Zion, and there rejoice in your salvation. The nations have fallen into the pit they have dug. Their feet are caught in the net they've hidden. The Lord is known by his justice. The wicked are ensnared by the work of their hands. Higion Selah. The wicked return to the grave, all the nations that forget God. But the needy will not always be forgotten, nor the hope of the afflicted ever perish. Arise, O Lord, let not man triumph. Let the nations be judged in your presence. Strike them with terror, O Lord. Let the nations know they are but men. Selah." So the first word begins, we've seen this one before, lemnatzeach, to the director, to the choir master, whoever the menachseach is, that's who this is for, just like many of the other psalms. And then the second phrase, almut labain. This is, the NIV translated this as, to the tune of the death of the son. Now that is a guess, and it's an educated guess, because al could be the preposition meaning according to, or concerning, or about, or upon. And then mut is the word for death. So mut labain, death of labain, the son. That's possible, but that's not how the Septuagint translated it. The Septuagint translated it as uper ton krufion to huiu, according to or on behalf of the secret things, the hidden things, krufion to huiu, of the son. So L-E-S, for the end, on behalf of the secrets of the sun. All of the translations, for the most part, though, Lexham English, King James, JPS, the RSV, NRSV, ESV, Holman Christian Standard, Christian Standard, they all just leave it transliterated. Muthlabain, for the leader, upon Muthlabain, for the leader, al Muthlabain, to the choir master, according to Muthlabain. So we don't know what was this a tune? Was this saying this was written on this occasion? If so, who is the death of the son? Whose son? Some have even said Al-Muth comes from Al-Ma, which is the word for young woman or young maiden. And this actually is not upon the death of, but it is something like a young woman's voice or to be sung at, like a soprano or a high pitched. I don't know. I don't know of anybody that does know. So I think it's best to just leave it transliterated, which is what I do in my translation. Form Natseach. Al-Muthlabain, a song for David, which is what Mizmor le David, and we've seen that plenty of times in this first book of the Psalm. So that's the title, and then it begins, Ode Adonai b'kol levi, I will praise Yahweh Adonai with all my heart. I will count all your wonders. Esapra, I will count, or I will recount, as in I will retell, or I will tell people. But this verb, on its most literal level, means to count. And that's what the psalmist is doing. The psalmist is proclaiming, is considering, is counting, is numbering all of the wonders. Kol niflatheka, all your wonders. This is from the word pela, which is where we get wonder from. Marvelous deeds, all the great things you've done. This is how people in the Old Testament would describe the works of God in history. Whether it was the events of the Exodus and the plagues upon Egypt and bringing Israel out through the Red Sea, whether it was providing for Israel in the wilderness, whether it was the conquest and the supernatural protection that God gave Israel and the ability to overthrow these powerful nations. All of these things were wonders, the wondrous deeds that God had done. And so the psalmist, I will count all your wonders. The psalm begins by looking backwards to what God has done, and that then provides the rationale for trusting that God will do wonders again. So because of that, verse 2 in Hebrew, verse 3 in English, I will rejoice, I will exult in you. The verb samach and alatz, to rejoice, to sing praise, and to exalt, to magnify. I will sing your name, Elyon. And Elyon is a title for God, some translated as Most High. But the last psalm, Psalm 8, ended with a phrase about how great is your name. And now that name is what the psalmist is singing about. So this follows right from the last psalm, Psalm 8, just thinking about the wonders of God and how great his name is in all the earth. So now the psalmist is singing about this name. And then verse 3 in Hebrew, verse 4 in English, it's a little awkward. The syntax is a little weird. It literally says, Beshuv Oyavai, in the turning, or shuv just means to turn or to return. It can even mean to repent. In the turning, I'm just going to leave it as turning, in the turning of my enemies, achor, back or backwards, yishchalu, they will stumble and they will stray from your presence or from your face. So when my enemies are turned back, they will stumble and they will stray from your presence. And so different translations handle this different ways. Lexham English says, when my enemies turn back, they will stumble and perish because of your presence. So they're taking from your presence as like on account of, from your presence, like your presence is what's making them stumble. Like if you say, I am tired from walking all day. King James just says, when mine enemies are turned back, they shall fall and perish at thy presence. The Tanakh, when my enemies retreat, they stumble to their doom at your presence. The Dead Sea Scrolls says, when my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before you. That's how the Holman Christian and CSB render it as well. When my enemies retreat, they stumble and perish before you. And then the Septuagint, when my enemy is turned away backwards, they will be weak and perish from your face. So the idea is like God's presence showing up either causes the enemies to flee, or when the enemies flee because they are defeated, they'll stumble and they'll fall, and or they'll be destroyed, or they'll waste away, or they'll perish, and they won't be in the presence of God anymore. It's just a colloquial way of saying they'll be gone, utterly destroyed. And why? Well, verse 5 in Hebrew, verse 4 in English answers, Ki asitha mishpati, for you did justice, and my verdict, You sat upon your throne judging righteously. What that means is, like translation have said, you have maintained my just cause, or as King James says, my right, my cause. And it's not just justice in a general sense God has done, but mishpati, my, that E ending, my justice. You have done my justice. Dini, my verdict. So you have done my justice and my verdict. Yashavta, you sat, the kisei shofet, tzedek. You sat to your throne or upon your throne, shofet, judging tzedek, righteous, righteousness. So this whole phrase, the psalmist is praising God because he has rendered judgment on behalf of the psalmist against the wicked. That's what it means in the Bible to do justice, is to remove the wicked and restore shalom. So Lexham English translates it well. It says, for you have maintained my just cause, you have sat on the throne judging correctly. And part of that justice and judging correctly is punishing the evildoers, is removing the wicked from the land. And that's what he praises in the next line. Verse 5, you rebuked nations, you destroyed the wicked, their name you wiped out forever and ever. The enemy, they were in complete ruins forever. Or this could be translated as the enemy, they were finished by swords mightily, or something like that. There's a little bit of question on what this charavoth means. Does this come from a word that means ruins, or is this from cherev, which is sword? Now, this is language that should bring readers' minds right back to the accounts in Joshua, where Joshua have these elevated, almost hyperbolic accounts militarily of the people, the Canaanites that God's sending Israel in as judgment against, utterly wiping out, blotting out their names forever, uses these same phrases. And then, of course, in the same book of Joshua and in Judges, it talks about now those who remained, which means that obviously it's not literal language of literally exterminating or wiping out people completely, but rather it's removing them as an entity, destroying the cultural residue of the Canaanites that God judges. Some scholars have said it's similar to how in modern sports writing, it'll talk about one team destroying another or annihilating the opposition or something like that. They've kind of likened it to, it's like the equivalent of ancient sports metaphor, ancient battle accounts. And I don't know how far you can press that. It does kind of get in the right direction because the accounts in Joshua are hyperbolic according to a close reading of Joshua itself. If you're interested in more on that, check out the video series we have here on the channel where we walk through the book of Joshua chapter by chapter and we look at examples of Joshua being hyperbolic in those claims. And interestingly, in this passage, Eugene Peterson in The Message carried that sports metaphor into this psalm. He translates verse 5 as, you blow the whistle on godless nations, you throw dirty players out of the game, wipe their names right off the roster. So he's very much keying in on that sports metaphor. I think that's not quite what the psalmist may have had in mind, but it's a fun way to think about what is being said here. So in language reminiscent of any ancient Near East king, after a king subdues his enemies, after a king overthrows strongholds of opposition and brings peace to the land, then the king sits on his throne and judges in fairness and shepherds his people. And these are all common expressions of what kings in the ancient Near East were expected to do. And this is what we see. Pick it back up at verse 5. We'll back up. You rebuked nations, you destroyed the wicked, their name you wiped out forever and ever. The enemy, they were in complete ruins forever. The cities you uprooted, their very memories were lost. But Yahweh forever sits, his throne establishing justice. And he will judge the mainland, the inhabited world, the inhabited land, in righteousness. He will judge peoples in uprightness. And Yahweh will be a refuge for the crushed, a refuge for times of drought. And some have translated this times of drought as times of trouble, but batsara literally is the word for drought. This is the type of king Yahweh is. He's like the ultimate ancient Near East suzerain. And that's what the psalmist is rejoicing in, exalting in. And so verse 11 in Hebrew, verse 10 in English, they will trust in you, the ones knowing your name. We would say in English, the ones knowing your name will trust in you. This is why they will trust in God. If they, the ones knowing his name, to know a God's name in the ancient world was a big deal. I mean, there are all kinds of incantations and spells pleading with the god, please let me have said the right name. If I've missed calling you by any name that you prefer, pretend that I know that name and I called it. There were ways of trying to decipher and discern the correct name of the god, because if you knew the name of the god, then you could manipulate the god to doing what you wanted done. That's how magic in the ancient Near East worked. Well, in scripture, it's not that way at all. God's name is God's identity, and knowing the name is not deciphering. It's not finding it out, not knowing like cognitively. I mean, the word knowing in Hebrew is the way you would talk about experiencing intimacy, including all the way up to sexual intimacy. But in this case, intimacy of relationship, of knowing God's name. So the ones who are in relationship with God, the ones who he is their God and they are his people, that's what it means when it talks about those knowing God's name. They trust in God. They will trust, batak, to trust, to put my trust in you. Because, key, for you have not forgotten the ones seeking you, Yahweh. So those who know God's name are the ones who are seeking you, Yahweh. There's the name is Yahweh. And those knowing and those seeking. To know God's name means to seek God. And so therefore, verse 11, 12 in Hebrew, sing to Yahweh, dwellers of Zion, those sitting in or living in Zion, declare among the peoples his deeds. For the avenger of blood remembered them. He did not forget the cry of the, and there's question about whether this should be the cry of the afflicted, aniyim, or of the poor, unavim. And this is what is written in the text, and the Masoretic notes have as the Kareh reading, which you should read, is this one. So it's either the afflicted or the poor. But regardless, those are concepts that are very similar, because usually the poor are afflicted, or people are afflicted because they are poor. Regardless, God has not forgotten their cry, tsa'acha, the cry of the poor, the needy. This is another theme that runs throughout the Bible. Almost all of the prophets key in on this. God does not forget the cry of the needy, of the poor, of the afflicted. Now this line, verse 12, for the avenger of blood remembered them. Literally it says, for the one seeking bloodshed, them he remembered. So it could be saying God remembered. In other words, he paid attention. To remember doesn't mean like, oh, I forgot and now I remember. It means to basically turn to notice. So it could be saying for God remembered, he didn't forget, he didn't look away from the ones who are seeking bloodshed, like the violent people. God remembered them in order to pay them back. That could be the sense of what this is saying. Or Doresh Damim could be the one seeking bloodshed or the one seeking blood. And that's the technical phrase for the avenger of blood. In other words, the one whose job it was when somebody murdered someone, a member of the family known as the avenger of blood, their job was to track down and put to death the murderer, to avenge the bloodshed. And so this could be referring to God as the avenger of blood. And it is singular, Doresh, this is a singular participle. So the one seeking blood, this could refer to God as the avenger, the ultimate one. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I will repay. This could be saying that God, the avenger of blood, like the ultimate avenger of blood, them he remembered. In other words, the ultimate avenger of blood remembered the poor and the needy, the afflicted. So they both sort of say the same thing. Ultimately, is God the one remembering and not letting go the ones who sought bloodshed, the bloodthirsty, the people who oppressed the needy and the afflicted? Ultimately, you arrive at the same destination, which is God is the ultimate judge, and that no crime ultimately gets overlooked. Even if people think they get away with it in the present, there will come a judgment day when all wrongs will be righted. And so the whole first half of Psalm 9 is this praising God because he has done these things, and this is the type of God he is, and he doesn't forget the afflicted, he doesn't forget the needy, he makes things right, he's the ultimate judge, he's the ultimate ancient Near East suzerain. But then, look what the psalmist does, verse 13, verse 14 in Hebrew. Show grace to me, Yahweh. See my affliction from those hating me. In other words, this is the type of God you are, and I've shouted your praises, and I've acknowledged all this. Now I need you to act on my behalf. You don't forget the needy and the afflicted. Well, God, I'm feeling pretty needy and afflicted right now. So I need you to do all that stuff for me. This is what the psalmist is saying. See or look upon, ra'eh, anayi, my affliction. See my affliction from those hating me, lifting me from gates of death, in order that I may count all your praises in the gates of daughter Zion. I will rejoice in your salvation. So this is a participle, lifting me from gates of death. There's question because in this verse, the participle is the ones hating me. And then the next participle, lifting me from gates of death. Some take that as it doesn't make sense if the people who are hating me are the ones lifting me from gates of death. Because to lift from the gates of death means like to gates of death is a way of saying death, the underworld, Sheol, the grave, destruction. And so God like lifting me, pulling me back from the pit, we might say. And that's how most of the translations take it. The Lexham English says, see my suffering from those who hate me, you who lift me up from the gates of death. Even King James says, thou that liftest me up from the gates of death. And that's what the Septuagint has. You are the one who lifts me from the gates of death. And the Holman Christian and the CSB both translated as actually an imperative, lift me up from the gates of death. But regardless, the parallelism is the same. The purpose of being lifted from the gates of death is so that, lama'an, in order that, esapra, this is that first word we saw back in the first verse, that I will count all your praises. And not just in general, but specifically, Basha'are Bat Zion. So the opposite of the gates of death, metaphorically, are the gates of Zion, the gates of God's holy city. And as a result, I will rejoice in your salvation, Bishuatecha. This is where Yeshua comes from, save, to be saved, salvation. It's where the name Jesus comes from. So lift me up from death that I can rejoice in your salvation. And then the psalmist goes back to the overall tone of this poem, which is declaring the way God is towards the wicked and the evildoers. Verse 16, nations sunk in a pit they made. In a net which they hid, their feet got trapped. So the image is, you know, is like somebody who's digging a pit in order to catch something, like to catch a, I don't know, a lion or something. You dig a pit, and it's saying they've fallen into the pit they dug. These nations, which earlier in the psalm were described as the wicked. And the net that they set out, the net that they hid in order to catch something, their feet got trapped in it. So these are two lines describing the evil of evildoers being turned back on them. And that's how verse 16, 17 in Hebrew, Yahweh made himself known. He did justice. By the deeds of his hands, the wicked is ensnared. This is like the way God does justice is typically he turns the evil of evildoers back on their own heads. He uses their weapons against them. The example par excellence of this in the New Testament is the cross. The very means of shaming, torturing, humiliating, crushing someone was crucifixion. And yet, that's the very means that God used to bring salvation to all of the world. Very much a biblical concept of how God's justice works. So there's something like a crescendo of this psalm, because then there's this pause, Higayon Selah. Well, not just Selah, but Higayon Selah. And all of the translations just transliterate this because nobody knows what Higayon means, and Selah, they don't know what that means either. So Higayon Selah, Higayon Selah, Higayon Selah. And so the fate of these wicked, the fate of these nations that oppose God, these people who hate the psalmist, the people who afflict the poor, verse 18, 17 in English, the wicked will turn to Sheol. And there's that verb again, yashuvu, they will turn. And this could also be the wicked will return to Sheol. If that's the connotation it has, then the idea is that Sheol is where they belong. Death is where they came from, and they're going back to where they came from. But the wicked will turn to Sheol, all nations forgetting God. The wicked are, in parallel, all the nations forgetting God. So not just all the nations. It's not like nations equal wicked. It's the nations forgetting God, the nations going their own way, who have exchanged the truth of God for a lie, as later Jewish writings like Wisdom of Solomon or New Testament Romans 1 put it. And they'll return to Sheol because not forever will the needy be forgotten. In other words, things are not always going to be the way that they currently seem to be, that the psalmist is lamenting about. So therefore, the psalmist lifts up a cry, "Arise, Yahweh, Kuma Adonai, arise, Yahweh, get up, God." This is not the first time the psalmist has said this, and it won't be the last. This is a frequent call in the Bible for God to get up and do something, arise, you know, like you're the king, you're the judge, you're mighty, stand up and show who you are. This is the cry that the psalmist gives. Let not the human be strong. And this collectively, this is the word anosh. It's kind of just means generically human, person. You might say mortal as opposed to God. So don't let the human nations, the human rulers, the human oppressors, anosh, don't let them be strong. Let the nations be judged by your face, or in your presence, or according to your presence. So again, this is handled differently by different translations. Like some, "Rise up, O Yahweh, let not humans prevail. Let the nations be judged before you." King James, "Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the heathen be judged in thy sight." The Tanakh, "Rise, O Lord, let not men have power. Let the nations be judged in your presence." The New Revised, "Rise up, O Lord, do not let mortals prevail. Let the nations be judged before you." The Message puts it funny, "Up, God! Aren't you fed up with their empty strutting? Expose these grand pretensions." He continues, verse 20, 21 in Hebrew, "Set, Yahweh, fear upon them." In other words, God, put fear in them. "Let them know, nations, anosh chema, anosh, human they are," or that they are mortal, that they are mere human. Don't let them be strong. Don't let the anosh be strong, this wicked mortal. Rather, let them know that they are mortals. In other words, put them in their place, God. And this is not strictly metaphorical language, because many kings of the nations in the ancient world did consider themselves divine. I mean, Pharaoh considered himself the firstborn son of Ra. Numerous kings in the ancient Near East considered themselves as descendants of the gods, or as demigods themselves. And so the psalmist is crying out, God, show them that they're just people. Selah. And so here we have a pause. It's the end of the psalm if we follow the Hebrew order, or this is another pause if we're following the Septuagint order. So that's Psalm 9 in our English Bibles. It focuses on the type of God God is, a God who avenges bloodshed, a God who puts things right, a God who hears the cry of the afflicted, a God who overthrows and wipes out the wicked. This is the psalmist lifting up God's reputation, and within that context, crying out to God saying, now be this in my sight. Be this in my life. Be this in this situation that I'm looking at and that I'm lamenting. This is a lament psalm where the psalmist is crying out to God and almost ordering. I mean, it's not really ordering. It's pleading with God. Get up, God. Stand up, be the type of God I know you to be. This is something that you see a lot in the Psalms, especially in lament Psalms, is you see this boldness to hold God to account for who God has revealed himself to be already. It's not like the person is saying, hey, God, do this because I want it, or do this because it's going to be good for me, or do this because I hate that guy, or whatever. It's do this because you have done this before. Holding God to his reputation, this is part of the prayer life of Israel. How often are we willing to have this boldness, not ordering God around, but holding God accountable to God's own revealed nature when things don't appear to be going right? Now, in the second part of this psalm, in Psalm 10, we're going to see the flip side, and we're going to look more at what exactly these wicked are doing that's making the psalmist cry out to God. So Psalm 9, the focus has mostly been on who God is in relationship to the wicked. In Psalm 10, it's going to kind of be the reverse, the negative, like a photographic negative. It's going to be a look at who the wicked are in their relationship with God. And so together then we get the full picture of God and justice and the wicked and wickedness and how we should view all of that and cry out to God in the midst of it. But that's all for now. If you enjoyed this video, be sure to check out the others in this series. If you haven't already, we really appreciate if you subscribe to the channel, if you like and share the video, get word out about Disciple Dojo. So thankful to all of you who have supported this channel, who subscribe, who tune in. You guys are awesome and really appreciate it. That's all for now. Stay tuned when we look at Psalm 10. And in the meantime, as always, keep training.